Beyond the Mic with Sean Dillon.
We're joined on the star line by one of the most empathic explorers around. His photography has won awards. He survived a polar bear on the hunt and charmed sea snakes. He's out on tour talking about the life on thin ice as a National Geographic explorer. We welcome Keely Yuyan.
Good to be here.
Keely, let's go Beyond the Mic. As a photographer of wild places, things, and people, you've immersed yourself in the world. Why is your Siberian native Chinese-American heritage so important for you?
I mean, where we come from shapes who we are, right? And so much of my upbringing was this sort of combination of traveling all over the place and being both raised by people that were trying to just make it in the world. But, you know, as a child of immigrants, especially, we spent a lot of time playing outside. And you grow up learning so much about the outdoors when you actually spend so much time out there, even the basic stuff, chasing bugs and lizards and all that stuff. And eventually things get bigger and bigger.
How important is preserving indigenous history and your own heritage to you?
I don't know if I would say preserving is quite the right word. I'm really interested in trying to understand where all of our cultures are coming from and the different perspectives that they have, because I think that human diversity is an amazing thing. And, you know, it's like most of the news about the world comes from a few dominant cultures in the world, right? And so we sort of think that the problems that plague us have to be solved or unsolvable. But actually, there's vastly more human cultures than just the few minority ones that sort of dominate the world. And they've solved a lot of the problems that exist in the world, you know, like just in their own ways. And so I think that there's just brilliant models to look around and to see all the different human cultures that are living in such different ways. And a lot of them are beautiful ways to live.
When you embed yourself in an indigenous community, you spend weeks building trust. How hard is it for you to leave after contributing to their membership?
Yeah, I mean, I love it to death. It's the thing that keeps me going, right? Like, I mean, I started on this journey in a lot of ways because I didn't grow up in my ancestral community. You know, like my grandmother was the person who largely raised me. And so for me, the sense of belonging that I never had growing up as a kid, growing outside of my community, means that when I go to a lot of these small remote communities, I feel like I finally at home. You know, I'm at the place where I was sort of meant to be as a child, and I fit right in. You know, a lot of the things that I did growing up are so natural to me, and they're also things that happen in these small communities, like hunting and fishing and looking at the land and just spending so much time out there, just being out there observing and with the land itself. And, you know, the land is a great teacher. You know, it teaches you all of the stuff that is going on around you. You pay so much attention to the weather. You pay so much attention to changes that are happening over time. And it's, you know, anyone that spends a lot of time outdoors, but especially if you're a hunter or a fisherman or a farmer, it's one of those things where if you're one of those folks, then you truly have a better, closer understanding of how the natural world works. You know, and it's beautiful.
Do you communicate with them after you leave?
I do, definitely. Some communities I'm closer with than others. There are some of which I, you know, now after decades of going and visiting, you know, I'm definitely, it's like second family to me, you know, so I'll go and I've been to graduations. I was just at a graduation. I've gone to funerals, gone to birthdays, you know, and I'll just show back up again because it's like, you know, I'm part of the family now. And that's what happens. It's not true for every community. That would be too much, but I try to go back. It's because all of those relationships are important to me. Yeah.
When you're out on a shoot, how does communicating with your own family change?
Well, I'm usually really remote, so it changes in that they can't get in touch with me. I think in a lot of ways, honestly, spending a lot of time around remote Native communities has helped me really connect with my own family in a lot of ways because they see what I'm doing and it helps them to understand that, like, my journey in a way. I can come back and present to them and sort of I can take them on the journey that I went by going through the photographs, and they're like, oh, cool, look at that. That's so similar to what we do, or oh, that's so different. You know, this reminds me of your grandmother or whatever it is. And, you know, that sort of connection and going deeper just to understanding culture has also made them realize that, like, the ways in which, having mostly grown up in America, the things that annoyed them about me growing up, that I didn't share the same you grew up in a different culture than your parents, and so you don't necessarily share all the same values because you grew up in a different culture. But they start to understand it more, as I bring the world to their doorstep, we all are able to talk about this stuff, and it's great.
Out on tour talking about the life on thin ice as a National Geographic explorer, Keely Yuyan joins us for The Rocking Eight. Mm-hmm. All this is 8 random questions. Keely, all you have to do is answer with the first thing that comes to your mind. There's no pressure.
Excellent. Excellent. I love it.
Keely, how many kayaks have you built, and do you still have your first one?
I've built over 700 with students. And no, I don't have my first one anymore. I actually don't even remember which my very first one was. Oh, no, I do. I spent a lot of time fishing for it. That's right.
Where is the one place you haven't visited but still want to?
Honestly, I don't really have a bucket list. I've been to so many wonderful places that as a human being, what I do is I mostly try to go back to the places that I really love because the people, I guess I'm getting older. And the relationships that I already have are so valuable to me. I love the people that I kind of, it's not like I'm traveled out by any means. I love seeing new things, but the most valuable things to me are watching kids grow up in the communities that I've already visited. It's like seeing all of those things advance. It's a beautiful thing.
Do you have different nicknames from different tribes, or is there a nickname that is stuck?
Here's a funny one. So the word Keely, my first name is a really common word in a lot of different languages. And I wouldn't say it ends up being a nickname because it is my actual name, but the different meaning of the words, people will call me Keely, but sometimes in some cultures, it'll come with good and the bad, for Lakotas, Keely is like means very good, great. It's like one of the best words that you could have. But then in Finnish, it means little boys. Penis. So that's like, you win some, you lose some, what can you do?
You're known for your grin, but when was the last time you frowned?
Oh man, you're asking me to go deep here. I'm a pretty joyful person. Yeah, I try to be on the light side of things.
Keely, what's your favorite photograph of yours that people haven't seen yet?
I was just recently ice diving in Greenland, and I have a picture of one of my fellow divers underneath the ice, and it looks like an astronaut floating in an asteroid belt. There's all, we're underwater and there's all these chunks of ice, and it's just beautiful and so wild. And the only thing that almost gives it away is because there's a line attached to the diver that goes up into the ice, so you sort of like, wait a minute. Hold on.
That's not supposed to be there.
Yeah, exactly. But aside from that, it'd be hard to tell. It's beautiful.
Yeah. What's your favorite type of whale?
Orcas. They are very near and dear to me. In fact, actually, orcas are relatives in my culture for the nice.
What's the last thing you either hunted or fished for?
I guess I was just whaling for bowheads last week. Bowhead whales. Yeah.
What's your typical meal on the road and at home?
Oh, gosh, is there a typical meal? My go-to is always a really good ramen because you can go just about any place on earth and find ramen nowadays. It's a really solid go-to. But my very favorite foods are the livers, the fresh livers, especially of seal. Like seal liver is just one of my very favorite foods. I love it to death. I can't always get it. You have to get it fresh, but it is most excellent.
Add on tour about the life on thin ice. It is Keely Yuyan, a National Geographic explorer, joins us for the back half. Keely, how has the way you see the world change after floating underneath the sea and under ice?
Like diving in general really gives you a sense of awe. I think you talk to anyone who spends a fair amount of time diving and you just like, there's a real sense of like the incredible beauty that is our world. And I think until you dive and explore that world down there and get immersed in it, it's hard to get that sense of awe in that same way because humans, we really don't spend that much time underwater, And so just to be in that world and feel like a little bit of an alien is sort of odd. But it is, I think, when you're down there too, you spend a lot of time with animals and you get so much closer. On top side, getting close to animals is really tough. If you're getting close to them, you're often hunting or observing them, but they don't usually let you get very close. But underwater, a Pacific giant octopus might come up, like just a few weeks ago, a Pacific giant octopus actually came up to me and tried to pull my mask off. And it was just
Wow.
like, it was like reaching out to just be curious and hang out with me. And then it stuck it. Yeah, it stuck its like, tentacles, or arms, basically across my mask and across my face. And it was just like a lovely moment. Like, yeah, I was trying to keep it from pulling my mask off, which would have been a bummer. But at the same time, it's this moment of connection where you're like, holy cow. No one gets that experience. It's rare to have that awesome experience to be able to just hang out with a creature where you're kind of, you get it, you can see how curious and interesting it is, and you share a moment. And it happens all the time underwater. And that kind of awe is so beautiful. And I think especially underneath ice is an environment that's so strange and alien. It's so beautiful that you can't help but have a sense of like, holy cow, imagine what the hell's out there. And this is just like on Earth. All right, like imagine what else is out there.
You said, quote, "The greatest thing, the only thing to sustain an artist is the work itself," unquote. What does it mean for you when youth embrace your work and gets that spark of inspiration from your life?
I think it's different things for different people. And but I love that if my work inspires, that is phenomenal. And I think the most the biggest thing that I want people to take away, if they're especially if they're have never been to any of the cultures that I'm photographing, I want them to have this takeaway that like that there are many ways to live, there are many ways to be in this world, and they're all just completely fascinating and really amazing. But if you are a lot, I do I am around a lot of indigenous youth, and one of the things they often take away are being able to see themselves in the photographs and see the way that they grew up or the things that they're familiar with be in a photograph and sort of be legitimized in that way is really meaningful to them. It's like, oh, the only way to exist in the world doesn't mean I have to become a YouTube influencer or whatever. like that's not the only cool thing, but actually seeing like my pic, my uncle's picture hunting seals in the pages of National Geographic is really meaningful to them. It makes what they're doing and their culture seem really, it makes it more important to them. It makes it seem cool and that is so tremendous.
How's the way you grow relationships changed from when you first started?
I think some of it is getting older. When I first started, you're always kind of looking out there for new experiences and going out there. And as I get older, I want to develop those relationships more and more. But I think the other thing about it too is that now as a because I'm a journalist and especially a photojournalist, as a photojournalist, you can't report from far away. You have to put the thing that in front of you that you're photographing, and so you have to be there. And in order to show people emotion or to show get people deeper into what it is that's going on, you have to be there when that person is unveiling their emotions. Like, so that means you have to be there in an intimate moment where the trust is built up so well that you can photograph it, and they not only show that thing to you, but they let that be photographed. And so that means that you learn to build trust with people, and that means you yourself have to be both trustworthy and vulnerable. And so I share things about myself. Like I've learned to share about my own self things that are like, when I was younger, if you go, oh, I'm embarrassed or this is stupid, like this doesn't reflect well on me or whatever. But I've realized actually that's all of us. We all do stupid things, and when we share about themselves, we are become more human, and everyone else identifies with it more, and that like ultimately in the long run, building trust with people is like there's just the most magical thing. And I think that the way that I approach relationships with people is different now. Before it was kind of just like I don't know, fit in and get people to take you seriously. And now it's a little bit more like offer something to people, be there for them, be a part of their lives, be a part of that community. And that's sort of a really different thing. It's sort of a me versus we kind of thing.
Speaking of starting first, how do you go from a BHA in design, metaphysics, and cognition to being an award-winning photographer?
Okay. Yeah. So first of all, that degree comes from it's an interdisciplinary degree, and I was like, what, the second class to ever come out with it. So at the time, we all make up the words for our degree. So I was like, oh yeah, I'm gonna make this sound amazing. Design, metaphysics, and cognition. That sounds really, that sounds like you got your money's worth. But I think what I really learned about in an interdisciplinary degree is probably still the most valuable thing ever, which is that learning from different places and cross-pollinating those different disciplines is maybe the best thing. That is just the most wonderful thing, because you learn something and then you apply it in a completely different field, and suddenly you get insights that no one's ever come across before. That people haven't thought about before. What you're doing is you're looking at things in such a new way. And that is so much of who I am as a human. I come from different cultures. I'm American, I'm Chinese, I'm Nanai, Hotuchu, and so I'm a photographer, I'm a boat builder, I'm a reporter. So all of these things. And so being able to cross these disciplines and see the magic that happens from, that's what I learned in school, ultimately, at the end of the day. The specific skills were important, of course, but at the end of the day, I think the most important thing I really learned was how important it was to just be curious and to like not be afraid to dive into new things that I didn't know anything about.
Keely, you're not the only person in this interview with an interdisciplinary degree.
Yeah, no kid, no doubt. Right on, right on. That's sweet.
You said, quote, "The world is full of stories, but how many of these stories don't tell us what we already know," unquote. Keely, I want to know your favorite story.
Probably the most, I think my favorite story that is really powerful is the story of the whaling community of Alaska. So, nowadays, from the 1980s on, there was a kind of this Save the Whales movement, right? And like worldwide now, people really generally love whales, and they're not real stoked on hunting whales. And then, going to Alaska to the Inupiat community and seeing that they were hunting whales and spending time with them and learning about this culture that not only hunts whales, but they have since they basically had a ban. They in the 19 late 1970s, the U.S. government showed up and said, "Hey, you guys are hunting whales. We can't let you do that. The population's really low. You're going to make them go extinct." And they fought it in court, and they won the right to manage their own whales. And once America had banned its own whaling, what happened is the Inupiat under management managed to quadruple the population of whales in about 30 years' time. So they managed their own whales while hunting them and quadrupled the population. And that is just something that is just so mind-blowing that a vast majority of Westerners would consider to be contradictory, that you hunt something but you love it. And they love it, they love the whales to death. Like there's whales in every bit of symbology, every logo, every house door has got a whale on it. Like to be a whaler is to have this love for the whale that and to understand whales at this sort of deep, deep level. And it's the core of the society. Like, as a community, they're so communal. They're the most sort of we care about each other because of the whale, because you can't hunt a whale by yourself. It takes a whole community to do it and to share in the spoils when you do get a whale. And so that working togetherness that they have is unbelievably interesting and fascinating, and I think that that was the thing that really blew me away was, here's a story that hardly anyone knows, and yet it's a shining example in the world of ecology. Like scientists know, or especially ecologists know, this story of one of like the Inupiats, the Alaskan Inupiat, are like the poster children for indigenous ecological knowledge, because they took an animal and then quadrupled the population. So it's pretty amazing. That's a lot to it.
National Geographic explorer Keely Yuyan joins us beyond the mic. Let's talk about learning. Taught you to first build a kayak, and how important is it for you to pass it on?
Passing on anything that it is I learned becomes more and more important every year that goes by. I don't know. I just think I just have a real love for sharing the stuff that it is I learned, because I find it so fascinating and interesting. I can't help but share it. But when it comes to kayak building, teaching this stuff is about what I learned is that teaching about any particular skill especially for young people, is a little bit less about teaching the specific skill that matters. You teach someone photography, you teach them how to build a boat, but what you're really teaching them is how to go out and look at life, how to go through life, how to be interested in learning stuff, how to go do something that's scary. There are people, I have young people who would show up at the workshops who had never held a drill before.
Never.
And here they are. Yeah, never held a drill before. And are by the end, at the end of 9 days, they start with pieces of wood and they end up with a finished kayak, which is, if you know boat building, that's the high art of woodworking, right? And it is a quite a lot of stuff to know and to understand. And so they've learned how to do this stuff and they come away with this incredible sense of like self-esteem because they've been able to do something that's just absolutely incredible. And they paddled them on the last day. They finish and then they're paddling their kayaks on the last day. So that kind of, self-confidence, but also just this notion that like they can learn to do things that they thought previously impossible is so eye-opening. And it's not just with young people. I find adults too, we will get tech people who come and are so fascinated because at the end of every day, you look back and you've done something. You look back and you're like, oh, you started with wood on this day. And the next day, it looks like the whale skeleton because it's already framed. There's already ribs sticking out and it's beautiful. And then you have people who go through like decades of their lives and never have anything to look back on and show for it. You work in tech and you don't see what you've actually done. There isn't like a thing. But when you build a physical object, you actually see it growing. You see it come to life in front of your eyes, and that's something that's so fulfilling for people. So I think that sense of accomplishment and a sense of like being curious and being willing to try things is probably the most important thing to instill. I hope that it gives people.
Who helped you become a better photographer then?
Lots of people. I'd say that probably, I don't know. I think that in a lot of ways, my journey of becoming a photographer is in a lot of ways very similar to a lot of other National Geographic photographers in the sense that we absorb art all around us our entire lives. I didn't go to school for photography. I learned partly from the internet. I partly learned just by going out and taking pictures. But I think the important part was that I had art in my life throughout much of my life. I went to school for design. And then I was also, because I was a kayak builder and because I was interested in cultures and animals and spent time outside, like that was the most important part. Because as a photographer, if you don't have a story to tell, you're basically a technician, right? If you are, you can, there are some wonderfully technically competent photographers out there who can photograph anything in the technically correct way and yet have nothing to say. And so the photographs are lifeless. And then there are people who are incredibly emotionally attached and understand a subject really well and don't have technical mastery of their cameras and yet can produce amazing work because it strikes us in the heart. And I think ultimately at the end of the day, that's the thing that allowed me to become a good photographer is because I didn't pick up a camera till I was in my 30s. I didn't even start the journey of photography till I was in my 30s because I was busy doing all the other things. I was too busy living. And it's so true for a lot of the National Geographic photographers who are out there doing stuff, living and trying new stuff and being fascinated, falling in love with the world and having your hearts broken and doing all the things that life requires. And then by the time you get around to the photography, you know what's important. You have stories to tell. You have something to photograph.
Keely, why is storytelling important to you and your future?
Storytelling is important to me because honestly, I think that it's it is communication. When we communicate, we're talking in stories all the time. It's the most important thing. If you whenever you have a conversation with someone, what you will truly remember is the stories that you tell, right? Like if I tell you a story of being attacked by a polar bear, you remember that way more than anything else that I will tell you in this conversation. I mean, it is kind of an exceptional story, but.
I want people seeing you tell that story when they see you speak about life on thin ice. So, Keely, where's the place where you've learned the most?
Where do I learn the most? I learn the most being around other cultures. And I think I probably learn the most, especially being around Arctic cultures. They have such a different perspective on life, the just so different from the South where ice rules everything, snow and ice. and weather rules everything. And so you are so tuned into what's going on in the world around you, the weather around you. And I think that's, it's astounding how different it is from much of the rest of the world.
The indigenous people were originally isolated by circumstance. Are they now somewhat isolated by design, or how does technology change their isolation?
I wouldn't say, I don't, there's very few cultures out there really that I would say are isolated. There are a few that are pretty remote, but these days, isolation doesn't exist that much. There's probably a few places in the Amazon, the Congo, where they're isolated. But I do think that remoteness definitely makes a big difference. And we see that, especially in Arctic regions where you might get one ship that shows up in a year and sometimes it doesn't make it because of the sea ice. It's not possible for a shipment of goods to make it, which means that everything you need to depend on, it has to come from the land around you, the sea around you. And so you can't afford to not take care of the place that you're living in. I mean, if you go and hunt all the walruses, then good luck next year. Right? And so that kind of mentality about it, I think is so it's such a, you have to think many generations into the future. You cannot think about just the short term or just, you have to really, really think about not just your own life, but the life of everyone around you and your generations into the future. And that's so cool.
I know you don't have a bucket list, but what's the one story you haven't tackled yet?
I am working right now on I've got a couple ideas going. One of the really cool ones is this notion of talking to whales. Right now, there's a lot of people that have been talking about using AI to communicate with whales. Like scientists are trying to decipher humpback and sperm whale communication. One of the things that I've discovered in talking to some other indigenous peoples is that we all, a lot of us actually have stories where we sing to whales, or we speak to whales, or we listen to whales and other marine mammals, seals as well, including my own culture. And I talk about that in Life on Thin Ice. But the what I'm really interested in lately is what is this these cultural viewpoints of where we talk, where we speak to other animals. And actually communicate with them is really cool. It definitely exists. It's not like a, I think that what we're trying to accomplish with using AI to try to figure out what animals are saying to each other or to us is a little different than what we accomplish when we sing to whales. And yet, we don't need all of this sort of fancy technology to have this connection to those animals. And that's so cool. And I'm looking forward to working on that, and looking around the world and seeing how humans connect with animals, in the water.
Keely Yuyan joins us beyond the mic for one big question. Keely, you said, quote, sea ice is the basis for life in the Arctic. But those who weren't raised in the North are hard-pressed to understand how the ice is changing, unquote. What is the future problems that face the people of the Arctic?
Things are changing really dramatic, and it's a little bit hard to, in some ways, it's a little bit hard to explain without explaining how important sea ice is. But to give you an example, in a place like North Greenland, where you cannot, you can't expect the ship to show up every year. There are, sometimes the ship just, a ship with goods will not come. And so you have to be able to hunt in order to have any food at all. This is a place where when there is flour in stock at the store, a pound of it costs $30 or $40.
What?
A pound of flour. Yeah. So, it just gives you an idea of like what that is like, right? And so in order for you to eat, you have to hunt. The plants don't grow up there. There is, nothing grows. It's all ice and snow. And
Wow.
so, in order for you to access things like the narwhals or seals, in order to hunt, in order to eat, it all depends on the sea ice. And if the ice is rotten and squishy, that and it's unstable, that means you can't stand on it, which means that you can't get to the edge where the water is, where all the animals live. And so it can be stuck like that for months and months. It could never go away until it could be so unstable and dangerous that you could never go out on it, which means there's months and months and months where there's you can't access food. You
Wow.
can't get out there to hunt, and you have to live off of what you've already gotten and stored. And so that's a really, really big deal, to that's sort of a, it gives you a little bit of a glimpse into what life is like. But another great example is that most places in the far north, rivers are the highways, right? When the rivers freeze, that's how you get from one place to another. So winter is actually people's favorite time to go visit each other because you have these frozen sort of roads that you can go down, and you can either take a dog sled or you can ride a snowmobile. To go far away to go see people in other villages or in towns, even, like even places that are pretty modern. You'll say like Kotzebue or Nome, Alaska. They have some road system, a tiny bit of road system, but if you want to go see anyone else outside your tiny little town, you're going to have to get on a frozen river, and that's the way to do it. And so, without that ice, as that ice changes, that is a really big deal. And when that ice changes, it's a big deal, not just in the sense you can't visit your friends, but if you're trying to go visit your friends and then the ice breaks, you're not visiting anyone anymore. That's the end.
When people see your talk Life on Thin Ice, what's the thing you want them to take from it?
I think I want to have people take away the sense of awe and wonder that our world is as magical as it is. Like the Arctic is especially fascinating and interesting because it is so different than people in the South have a notion for it. But it also goes to show us how magical human beings are. As people are amazing, and all the different pockets of humans all over the place live in such different ways and have so much different wisdom to share. And I hope that people come away with a sense of like, wow, our world is pretty fucking cool. It's pretty rad. And so hopefully they'll want to go and experience it, be part of it.
He doesn't have a bucket list, always eats ramen on the road, out on tour. Talking about the Life on Thin Ice as a National Geographic explorer. Keely, where can people find you online?
I am at Keely.com or on my Instagram, which is Keely Yuyan. So it's a little bit hard to spell, but it's KILIIYUYAN.
Keely Yuyan, thanks for taking the time to talk with us today.
Hey, great to talk to you, Jeff. Yeah. Thanks for being here.
And that, my friends, is Beyond the Mic. If you're enjoying these conversations, please check out another Beyond the Mic episode to find more actors, artists, and people you need to know. We'd also appreciate a like and subscribe on the Good Pods app.